Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme is Google's covert operations to undermine democracy and freedom of speech and manipulate our lives. My guest, who came from inside Google, is Zach Voorhees. Zach is a former Google engineer who worked with the Silicon Valley giant for over 8 years. Much of that time was spent in Google's YouTube division before he discovered Google's artificial intelligence program known as Machine Learning Fairness. After investigating this program through internal Google documents in his possession, Zach turned whistleblower and delivered 950 pages of company documents to the Department of Justice and released the same to the public. Having departed from Google, Zach is now devoted to helping raise awareness about Google's covert activities. This includes the likelihood of meddling in the coming elections and collaborating with China by giving that country access to its Manhattan Project known as DeepMind. Nice to have you back with us, Zach.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be back.
Before discussing the lawsuit you and former Facebook employee and whistleblower Ryan Hartwick have filed, I want to first, if you would please, lay out the scope of the territory for how Google and other social media platforms such as YouTube and Facebook have the capacity to manipulate our attention and thoughts towards their own ends and benefits. And in recent years, the term techno-fascism is being used more frequently for suppressing whatever can be called misinformation or fake news, and has resulted in ever-increasing censoring and banning of posts and websites. The questions then are, what is the mechanism by which this authoritarianism is being implemented to affect people's lives without anyone paying attention? And then, who ultimately benefits from this techno-authoritarianism? What are the alliances in place that have turned companies like Google away from supporting democratic principles on the Internet? And could they have had any role to play, or Facebook, in the current presidential elections that are still being determined? Take your time. The forum is yours.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Gary. And you'll have to remind me some of those questions because you rattled off quite a few. But let me just start at the scale of Google. And Google serves up 500 million searches a day. That's half a billion. That is roughly 1.5 searches per individual within the United States, man, woman, or child of every age. And so it's quite obvious that Google's reach in the United States is unprecedented. There's never been a company the size of Google and the reach of Google. And when they started out as a software company, they promised the world that they would organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. That was their mission statement in the late 90s, and that's still their mission statement to this day. And yet they've betrayed this mission statement day in and day out by engaging in a form of censorship, which I call bit burning. You know, the fascists of 100 years ago burned books. The fascists of today burn bits. And Google is essentially a bit burner. And how can they possibly say that they organize the world's information and make it universally accessible when they're banning content? And so this is the thing that I've been struggling with when I was at the company for 8.5 years, and in the last final 3 years at my time there, Google decided that they were going to start changing their algorithms and introduce this concept of machine learning fairness, which is essentially critical race theory embedded as an AI censorship regime. When people think AI, it's kind of a overused term. You know, is it like chess? Is it like the thing that drives your car? Like, how do you, what kind of AI is this? And so machine learning fairness is a type of AI called machine learning. And the way that it works is that you take training data that's authored by humans and individuals. And then after creating thousands and thousands of test examples, you run it through a machine. And this machine then programs a classifier, which is called machine learning. And it's a collection of neural nets, which have a similar function to the way that a human neuron may work. And the problem with this neural net is that because a computer programmed it and not a human, virtually no human on the planet can analyze it and figure out what the heck it's doing. Even if a lawyer got electronic discovery and said, we want to look at these machine learning fairness algorithms, Google could give them full access. And no one could make heads or tail of what it does. It's only by running them does the output, like a black box, show itself. And so this machine learning fairness has essentially been released on the search engines. And I'm talking Google Search, Google News, YouTube Search. And it's being used in order to censor the whole internet. Now, people may think to themselves, well, you know, I heard that the censorship weapon was going to be Project Dragonfly. And that was my assumption as well. But when I was inside the company and I had access, I actually did a search for this Project Dragonfly and found that there was no trail of data whatsoever. It was a ghost, as if it didn't exist at all. But instead, what I found was a huge trail of data leading me to this machine learning fairness project. And it's got subcomponents. It's got Project Cripple Rain, which monitors in real time, 24 hours a day, all the things that are happening on Twitter and in news, and analyzes them and creates alerts so that individual operators working within Google can see things on a dashboard as they start trending and then make decisions about what to do. This was invented for the purposes of good, like monitoring an earthquake. The Fukushima earthquake is an example of this. It allows them to respond very quickly. But recently, it's being used to monitor the president's tweet and figuring out which things to censor. There's also other projects like BitTwiddler, which is a re-ranking algorithm. So when something runs and classifies something as fake news, or not trustworthy, or not, or lacking expertise, then Google is able to downrank it so that it doesn't actually get censored. It gets put instead on the 15th search result page. And so at least Google can say, well, we're not censoring, we're just downranking all the information that we don't like, which is essentially the same thing. Because face it, who really goes beyond the third page of the Google search results anyways? And so this has been the story of what Google's been doing for the last 4 years since Trump has been elected. They've decided to invert their entire company and apply more and more censorship to their search algorithms and the products that Americans use throughout the day in order to find information. Many of your listeners will notice that Google search results are degrading and degrading more often. And the crux of this is, you know, machine learning fairness on one end, but also the way that Google is ranking the entire internet according to what they call expertise, authoritativeness, and trustworthiness score. We shorten this to a concept called EAT, which is the acronym for expertise, authoritativeness, and trustworthy score. And the way that this score is applied to every website that's common and widely used is Google's got tens of thousands of raters whose job it is to go through a list of websites, take that website, and then figure out who's responsible for that website, what the topic of the website is, and then investigate those individual topics and people and places and things and figure out what their EAT score is. So the way that they do this is that, let's say there's a website, Gary Null, and people and a Google raider will go through. They'll take this website and they'll do a search for Gary Null minus your own website, because obviously your website, Gary Null, may appear at the top of the search results. And so by doing this, what they do is that they're able to see what other people are saying about the website. What is one of the strongest signals that they use to rate this thing? It's Wikipedia. And if you start seeing Wikipedia put slander and defamation against you or your website, then what you can be pretty certain of is that your website rankings are going to fall within the next quarter. And it's really funny because when people think about censorship, they always look at who's doing the censor, which is Google, and not who's holding the data, which is Wikipedia. And so Google uses this EAT score in order to re-rank the entire internet. This is the reason why things are getting harder and harder to find, because those esoteric posts, those things that we used to find on chat channels, those little nuggets of information, they now have such a low EAT score that Google will not return it. Instead, what they try to do is they try to return pages with a high EAT score, such as CNN or the New York Times or WebMD or these big pharmaceutical-backed information sources. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to funnel us into authoritative sources of information and get rid of what it is that the people think, because people are not experts. It's only the experts who are the experts. And so this is, you know, we're now at the end stages of this censorship regime. And YouTube is now, you know, falling back to just a mass banning of people that doesn't match its corporate policy. We're talking people that have had YouTube channels for 10 years, and YouTube is going through and saying, hey, we're going to delete your whole entire channel, and we're not even going to give you the decency of telling you why or what policy you violated. We're just kicking you off, but you can get us an appeal. But oh, by the way, your appeal only works if your channel isn't terminated, which is what we just did. And so on October 15th, some of Trump's biggest supporters in these massive channels online all got deleted at the same time in a giant purge. The reason that they said that they were encouraging violence in the real world because they're reporting on news. And so they were just with a keystroke deleted. I've been in contact with this network, and I've organized them into a lawsuit, which we filed against YouTube to create a temporary restraining order in order to restore these YouTube pages back. And at the time, we wondered if Google was setting up for something, but now with the election the way that it is and all the mess, and all the accusations of voting irregularities and suppression that's been going on, now it's clear to me, and it's my opinion, that Google is now taking part in a election coup. And what they don't want is they don't want individual content creators that are not part of the MSM to contradict the narrative of the MSM. And as a result, these people are all down, and now they're all fractured. And you know, Google could have done this back in July and allowed these supporters of the president to regroup under a different platform and for those platforms to go. But instead, what they did is that they did this purge 2 weeks before the election. They did this so that they wouldn't have a chance to regroup by the time all of these, in my opinion, deep state games with the election were going to be played. And so it's clear at this point that this is something that the deep state, including Google, has planned for a while. And what's going to happen in the next few weeks is probably going to be very traumatic, because they wouldn't go and, you know, violate their own mission statement if it weren't for something that was really, really important to them. And this is the reason why, you know, I saw this a year ago. In fact, I saw this in 2017 when I started looking at the power of Google and what they're able to do. And I realized that we as a country could be subverted by this monopoly. and that they were so powerful that they had the ability to rig an election. And that's the reason why I started collecting 950 pages detailing, the censorship regime, machine learning fairness, and a lot of the draconian features that they were getting prepared to release en masse to all their products. I saved them as PDFs to my laptop and then delivered 950 pages to the public and to the Department of Justice so I could give the American people one last chance and a year to prepare for Google's vote rigging, which I knew was going to occur, and now which we see the evidence of in this latest election games that they're doing.
Zach, I appreciate your courage because I'm sure, without knowing, and you'll tell us whether I'm right or wrong, that in order to neutralize the message of those 950-plus pages, they have to neutralize you. What efforts have you seen that Google has taken, or it's some of its affiliates, to try to kill the messenger?
I anticipated that I was going to get a reputation attack. And when I came out, they tried to paint me off as some crazy conspiracy theorist. But at this point, they ignore me, and here's why. What I've done is I've gone out and I've created an entire website called ZachVoorhees.com. And what I've done with this website is I've placed all the evidence of Google's crimes against the American people and their vote rigging, their censorship, their blacklists, all the things that they said. I mean, they've committed perjury against Congress. And so I put this all out there in the open for people to see, along with the 950 pages detailing their censorship regime. And so what happens is that if the mainstream media tries to write about me and people search for me in DuckDuckGo or a non-Google search engine, then what's going to happen is that they're going to see my website. It's now the first in many search engines when you search for my name. And they're going to come, they're going to see it, and then they're going to see that the reason that the mainstream media is attacking me is because I released all this information on Google. As a result of this defense that I've constructed, the media tries not to talk about me whatsoever. In fact, when the media ran hit pieces on my latest venture, which is suing Google over its policy violations and purging these YouTube content creators, the mainstream media was very careful to try to trash our lawsuit, but then at the same time, never mention me or my role or my crowdfunding campaign, which generated $130,000 in order to fund this thing. And that's by design. And for people that are out there that are thinking that they should blow the whistle themselves and are looking for strategy, my advice to you is to make yourself as searchable as possible. Learn a little bit of SEO, then create a WordPress so that when people search for your name, you're able to put out your own story and your own version, your own narrative. And if you can do that, then it's kind of like casting a spell. You get to, like, you know, define reality as in the way that it actually is and in the way that you see it. And you don't let the mainstream media set it for you. And I've seen other people, you know, come out and not do this strategy correctly. And as a result, the media redefines what the narrative is, what the story is. And then they're able to amplify it and do it over and over and over again. I saw this happen with Judy Mikovits. You know, she came out there and she had this amazing story. She got out there with Plague of Corruption, but she wasn't able to get out there and be SEO optimized with the search engines. And so once the mainstream media decided to attack her, she had a hard time being able to defend herself against credibility attacks. And you know, this is something that is a tried and true way. If you are a whistleblower out there, get a website under your name so that when people search for you, you're able to say exactly what you want to say.
Good. Zach, I'm going to ask one question directly within the boundaries of what you can talk about on your lawsuit, but then I have a larger overarching statement And within anything I'm saying, please select whatever you feel comfortable with to address. First, with the lawsuit, you brought on an attorney with a strategy to go against Google to file a legal suit and had filed an emergency injunction before yesterday's election. What is the background for the suit, and share whatever strategy you feel comfortable to speak about? And then after that, I'll get to the larger issue.
Mm-hmm. So the strategy here is that, you know, Google has a pretty advantageous terms of service that they've written so that they can pretty much do anything that they want. But even within this law, even within the terms of service, they were so sloppy with how they banned everyone that they didn't even follow their own terms of service. And so with this temporary restraining order, we said, hey, no, look, you know, the person that writes the contract has the largest challenge and the greatest burden to prove that they're not in violation of it. And so we said that, hey, YouTube, you created this contract. You have to follow by your own contract. And hey, judge, they're not following it. So we need to get a restraining order. And that restraining order's remedy is going to make sure that all of the YouTube channels come back on for a certain amount of time. And we also made a case that this was a Section 230 case. To remind you, Section 230 is the liability protections that was given in the 1996 Telecommunications Act. And in it, they say that if the if big tech acts as a good Samaritan in the way that they filter only lewd and lascivious content, then they get immunity from liability of a lawsuit. So, you know, if they've got some bad material and someone's doesn't like that, and they go and they sue Google, Google can say, hey, look, we're just a platform, and we have this immunity built in from Section 230 of the Telecommunications Act, and then the judge will dismiss it, and then everyone gets to go on. Now, here's the thing. If they don't follow this Good Samaritan, then as the law is written, they shouldn't be able to get this immunity. And so there's been many cases that have been tried to strip this immunity from them. Google's pretty much been able to defeat them all. But then there was a recent Supreme Court case called the Enigma case, in which Clarence Thomas wrote a dissent carving out a hole that allowed a new case to come forward to challenge the Section 230 provisions. In order to get that, you pretty much have to write your case in a certain way. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know exactly, you know, what the specifics of that are and are not. But our attorney, Chris Armenta, has structured our case so that it can wind its way up to the Supreme Court and challenge the Section 230 provision and strip Google of its liability protection. The thing is that if they get stripped of the liability protection, then you know, we should be able to get this restraining order for them. We because of the terms of service within the YouTube Content Creators Agreement, you cannot sue Google in any jurisdiction other than California. And in order to get this emergency injunction filed, we didn't want to have a jurisdiction fight. So we didn't want to, like, do it in Colorado. We didn't want to do it in any other place. So we just did it in California. And it was also strategic because the federal district court in California is ruled over by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And previously, this was called the Ninth Circus Court because it was known as so far left that it was known for making really hilarious rulings that didn't make any sense. And it was because of the politics that were playing in this court so strongly. In the last 4 years, Trump has essentially flipped this court, and now it's one of the most conservative courts ruling over the California federal district courts. And so what our strategy was is to bring it into the district court, get an emergency injunction, get that hearing. Our assumption was that we were going to lose in the first district court, and then we were going to shoot it up to the Ninth Circuit, and that if that didn't work and we lost there, then we would bring it all the way to the Supreme Court. So as of this morning, we've had a ruling that's come back. The ruling as we expected, denied our temporary restraining order, our emergency injunction. And so as a result, we our next step is to take this case and then appeal to the district, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And so that's what we're working on now. In fact, as soon as I get off the phone with you, then I'm going to get with the content creators and figure out what exactly, like, debrief them and then work with them for a coherent strategy. I'm not part of the lawsuit as a plaintiff because I don't have a large channel on there because my assumption was something like this was going to happen, so I didn't want to put the investment just to have my channel get destroyed. But I am acting as a consultant, a fundraiser, and an executive manager on this case. So a lot of the people that have been that are on this lawsuit that are named in the plaintiff pool are big channels like X22 Report that had nearly a million subscribers, SGT Report, Sarah Westhull, Jordan Sather, In the Matrix, Space Shot 76, Woke Societies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just Informed Talk is another one. And these, the commonality with all of these plaintiffs is that they were all banned on October 15th. Now, some of your listeners may say to themselves, well, hey, I got banned on October 15th. Can I join the plaintiff pool? And my answer to that is possibly. And if they want to get on the plaintiff pool, then what they should do is that they should come to our website. You can go to it at punchgoogle.com. That's all one word, punchgoogle.com. And there's a link to join the plaintiff pool. They'll have to fill out a questionnaire that that asks them to explain the story that they have behind their channel getting banned by YouTube and what their remedy, their appeal process was to try to get their channel back. And so this plaintiff pool is what I'm working with. And, between them, they have a reach of between 10 million and 30 million unique listeners of various states of subscription. Like, some of them were hardcore listening to the whole network, and then some of them were occasional visitors that would come like once a week or once a month to listen. But the estimated reach is between 10 and 30 million people. And so together, we've been able to fundraise the $130,000 that was necessary to get through this first phase. And we're committed to continue to fundraise this all the way to the Supreme Court. And we really do want to give Google a headache and let them know that, hey, we're watching you. And if you do this, we're going to, fight against you and make this a media event, which is currently what we're doing, right? Like, this is a story. It's coming out there. People need the hope. They don't like big tech stamping over the little guy anymore. And these content creators that have been getting stamped on, the reason why they got stamped on is that not just because they were supporters of the president, but because they had an independent narrative that wasn't bought out by, like, the pharma cartels. It wasn't bought out, like these legacy establishments like Fox or CNN or, MSNBC. These are independent content creators that are responsible for their own group of supporters. And because of that, their narratives that they were pushing in their news was closer to reality than anything else. Now, if you're a big totalitarian, and you own these, like, corporate legacy media channels, these little guys are a threat. They don't have any overhead. They're a one-man operation, one-woman operation in other cases. And these people are eating your lunch. Like, together, these people had more reach than MSNBC or CNN, one of these big channels. Maybe Fox News had, a bigger reach than all of them, but they were up there together as a network, being able to, compete against these legacy media channels. So, of course, the legacy media channels won them down. Of course, they found it intolerable to have a network of independent content creators contradicting and using reason and judgment and independent analysis and research to come to a different conclusion. And if you look back, what you see is that even people like Plato predicted that those who tell the stories rule over society. And what we see in our history is that we didn't have a lot of freedom of the press when it came to broadcast mediums. Maybe for the local newspapers it was true, but for the television, we had like what, like three TV channels in the 60s or the 50s. I wasn't born then, so I don't recall. But it was very few, and we had this like monolithic narrative for the whole country. As part of the modern society, is that we all had like the same car, the same suits, you know, the same style of stuff. We were all the same. And then the 70s happened, and there was this like 60s and 70s happened. We had this like fracturing. And the postmodernist theme is basically like almost infinite division between all these things. And so, you know, if you apply that to media, what you see now is that, you know, the media narratives are diverging. And as things get more divergent and the stories kind of come out of control of the oligarchs, then what happens is that people become more resistant to the propaganda that they're fed. And as a result, and I like to use an insulin and a diabetic analogy, when someone becomes more resistant to insulin, the doctor's going to prescribe them insulin in order to up their insulin levels so that they can, you know, lower their blood sugar. And in the same way, people are becoming more resistant to propaganda. And so what the oligarchs are prescribing is more propaganda to try to keep people in line. And that's what's going on here. And that's the reason why it's so important to preserve this network of sense makers, because these sense makers are making such an impact in society. And the impact hasn't really had something like it since the invention of the Gutenberg printing press, which essentially destroyed the church, because suddenly the cost of creating a book was reduced so that it was more accessible to the upper class. And so as books started being generated and the Bible started being replicated, people became literate and they started to realize that the church, the Catholic Church, wasn't, they weren't saying the stories as they were written in the Bible. And this had a fundamental change in society. If memory serves correct, I think this was the Gutenberg printing press caused the Protestant movement, which fought against the Catholic Church. And essentially what we see right here is a repeat of that. You've got this, you know, bureaucratic organization, the globalist mainstream media, if you want to call it that. And this broadcast system has stories that come from its internal collection of sense makers and then gets broadcasted out to the independent people, the normies, if you want to call that. And now with this independent media and this social media, what's happening is that the truth turns out to be way more engaging on social media than the lies that are constantly echoed around by these bureaucratic broadcast systems. And what happens is that if you create a social media system that shows you content based upon the interest of other people clicking on that content, then what happens is that the AI system of control is going to give you the stories that people just click on naturally. And if that means that people are clicking more on the truth than the broadcast lies, and what's going to happen is that these oligarchs are going to be challenged by new narratives. And these new narratives are going to cause society to fly apart. And what we're realizing now is that the news is fake. And what we realize, too, is that if the news is fake and we integrate that over time, what happens is that we get fake history. And this isn't a phenomenon that's just unique to the United States. As I interview people around the world from Brazil and Japan, they're having a similar awakening where they realize that the news is fake and that there's historical events that have been covered up, and that as they come up to the surface, they're realizing that entire empires have been written out of the history books. I don't know if you're aware of an empire called the Tartar Empire or Tartaria, but it was the empire that enveloped all of Russia, well, what's known as Russia today. And it existed like just over a century ago. And there's old maps that display this this kingdom. And for some reason, this entire kingdom's been written out of the history books. And, you know, as people go down and start, you know, becoming addicted, I mean, it's really an addicting thing to try to find out occulted history. What they find out is that there's a lot of stories that we've been told about things that don't exist that actually do exist. Like, for example, there was a biblical flood. The Columbia Gorge in the Northwest was carved out during this flooding event where the ice dam over North America burst open, a flood of water came out, and then carved out this gorge, gorged it out. It's literally called the gorge. Gorged it out and created this beautiful place where you can hike these days. And so, you know, when I was growing up, I was told that the flood was fake and it was just an old biblical story, but it actually turns out that it's got a lot of truth. And then it turns out that, well, maybe Atlantis is another place that existed, and it existed and no longer exists now because the sea levels, due to that great flood, raised the sea levels 500 feet. And so once you realize that, oh, well, the sea levels used to be a lot lower, you start realizing that there's a whole bunch of places that would have existed in the shallower parts of the world. There's an ancient landmass called Lemuria, which is next to Indonesia. And if you look at the map of Indonesia, what you notice is that it's got shallow water. And if the sea level were to drop 500 feet, you get this giant landmass where it would have been habitable in a very tropical area of the planet. And so, especially during an ice age, which is what caused the sea levels to drop. And so there's all this like rich history that is now being brought to the surface. And as it's happening, we're all kind of waking up in this great awakening and realizing that our history is much more fascinating, and that it's really the oligarchs that have rewritten the history in order to support their collection of power. And that really the projection of narrative is in its of power.
Zach, I appreciate that in-depth answer you just gave. And if you've just tuned in, I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, and Zach Voorhees, V-O-R-H-I-E-S, is my guest. And we're talking about Google's covert or secret operations to undermine democracy and freedom of speech and manipulate our lives, including what Zach was saying is the current election. You can understand why he's concerned about this, because he was an insider. You know, for 8 years, he was there as a Google engineer. He worked with the Silicon Valley giant, and this troubled him what he saw, including the machine learning fairness program, etc. Now, to a larger issue that is currently on everyone's mind, and that is COVID-19. I'm not asking you specifically about anything about COVID. However, here's what we do know that's based upon quality science, that it's a real virus, whether it was man-made or not, that is still to be determined. That it kills people, that is certain, and especially those with comorbidities. So thus far, everyone within the public health community is in agreement. However, here is what bothers us, and especially myself and other scientists. The original test to determine if you had COVID came from around the world. There were hundreds of different tests, and almost none of those, according to the latest science, has been shown to be accurate. But the current test being used, like the polymerase chain reaction or PCR test, is not specific, meaning it cannot tell you whether you have the current COVID-19 or an old cold virus from 5 years ago or 5 months ago. Your body killed it, and there's a particle of that virus. It's going to test that, and your results are going to come back positive. So the doctor's going to be told, yes, you're positive. The New York Times, then, and all the mainstream media report 9.2 million cases of COVID. Well, you think, wow, that's really bad. That's a lot of people are going to die. When that's not true by any measure. Also, for the first 5 months, they were including all of the different kinds of death from what the person originally had and was dying from. We saw that in Italy. We saw it in Spain, where people were in hospice care, were in nursing homes, dying from a lifetime of smoking and emphysema or cancer or heart disease, congestive heart failure. And yet, without doing autopsies, they said these people all died of COVID. So it artificially inflated the figures. And therefore, by those artificial inflated figures, and a professor who's been wrong many times at University of London, Imperial College, his mathematical model, a completely artificial construct, said that there's going to be a lot more deaths than what we've seen. And so governments panicked, and they put in these draconian measures of lockdown. Now what we're seeing is doctors all over the world and scientists, Nobel Prize winners, coming forward saying, you overreacted. The government should not have done lockdowns. They should have seen that children, infants, young people, people with healthy immune systems are fairly immune from the consequences. In fact, more so than what the flu. The flu will kill children at very high levels. And so we have kept people out of school that should have been in school. We've kept people at home without working and jobs lost where they should have been working. If we simply determined who was at risk and spent quality time with the best of medical care for them, for their diabetes, people who needed surgeries, because all these people, the moment they saw the people were dying in hospital from COVID, they didn't want to go to a hospital and get infected and die. So thousands of people have died who wouldn't have died in this period of time had they gotten proper medical treatment for their underlying actual diseases, not COVID. So then funeral homes started listing almost every death as COVID. And then a lot of the initial people were not treated properly. They should have been given hydroxychloroquine and zinc and azithromycin. They were not. They were just given ventilators and other medicines that did not work and increased the death rate. This is just the latest in this. Just to give you an example, this is from today, University of Arizona, quote, widely used rapid test detected only 32% of asymptomatic COVID cases, meaning people who were positive, but 68% were considered negative. When you have that high a false negative or false positive, that's a junk test. It should never be used. And yet that test is being used for all COVID now and with draconian measures. So here is the point. All of the scientists and the physicians who have come forward by the tens of thousands signing petitions. One group called Frontline Doctors, for example, did a demonstration in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. None of the media touched them. They're all being attacked, and they're all being deplatformed on Google and Facebook. Nothing they've said that would challenge the official narrative and therefore promoting a vaccine instead of doing what they could to prevent the disease and treat people with existing comorbidities to help them through this. None of that information is getting out. But everything about this Moderna's new drug that costs over $3,200 for treatments, that's being heavily promoted. But a study came out showing it doesn't work. It's not, and it's a lot of side effects. So it should be on the junk pile of history, but it's not. Almost $900 million in profits made. So Google and Facebook are allowing any advertisements, any promotion for this drug, this worthless, dangerous drug, and yet safe and effective drugs like hydroxychloroquine at low doses, 200, 400 milligrams, in combination with zinc and azithromycin, that's being banned as fake news and quackery. So entire groups of doctors and scientists are now attacked on these same platforms. Honest information is not allowed on. And the mainstream media knows this and is siding with Google and Facebook and Twitter and others to censor any information when we need this information in order to see what the next stage should be instead of just another disastrous stage two lockdown. And this stage two lockdown is coming when the new flu season is starting with winter. And guess what? Canada went from having almost 33,000 deaths last year from the flu, influenza, to 14. Well, how do you go from the last 3 years? We just checked, Richard Gell and I just checked the statistics. It was like 55, 44, and 33,000 deaths in all age groups. But now it's 14 because they shifted the pneumonia or the flu deaths onto COVID-19. This couldn't be by accident. Now it's getting serious. They've weaponized this, and the Americans are now approaching poverty. 66 million Americans, are actually food insecure. They don't have enough food to eat. We've never seen this kind of poverty and desperation. Suicides are up, and people dying at home are up in all age groups, and yet none of that is being reported on. It's just the official version. That said, could you then explain how Google, Facebook, are participating in this disinformation campaign and excluding anything that's honest and accurate scientific reporting.
Yeah, I mean, YouTube came out as a policy that they would censor any content that contradicted the World Health Organization or the CDC. And what's really interesting is that the CDC had conflicting opinions throughout this whole entire pandemic from start to finish. When this pandemic first was revealed in China, the WHO came out and stated that there was no evidence that there was human-to-human transmission of this virus. If I were to go and say today that there's no evidence of human-to-human transmission, I could have my channel deleted off of YouTube because they say that that contradicts the WHO today, right? But it doesn't contradict the WHO, you know, in November of 2019. And so, you know, this is something that YouTube has been very, you know, weird about. Like, ever since they've adopted this, you know, boosting of authoritative content and trash and suppressing of the trash fake news, they have been becoming more draconian with their censorship. There was an interesting video where the CEO, Susan Wojcicki, came out and stated that sites that were saying that vitamin C could be used to treat the effects of this virus were going to be deleted, channels banned, right? They do not want you to know that vitamin D and vitamin C can treat these things. Why? Because there's no authoritative source of information that's coming out and saying that this works, even though it's been long proven that vitamin C is a broad antiviral a nutrient that your body needs because it boosts the immune system. The FDA went in lockstep with this and launched an operation called Operation Quack Hack that started systematically taking down anyone that was advertising that vitamin C and vitamin D could boost the immune system against COVID-19. They said that that was marketing unlicensed drugs. Like, they really think that if you say that this can boost your immune system to fight COVID, that vitamin C and vitamin D become drugs such as, like, you know, similar to Ritalin or methamphetamine that need to be regulated by the FDA and have FDA testing. And the only way that you could say that vitamin C fights COVID-19 is if you pay off the FDA $2 billion to do a clinical study to prove that it does. And no one's going to do that because vitamin C is not a patentable product. It's a generic substance that can be created in a lab or extracted from these plants and put into a pill and sold for it's a very low margin product. And as a result, what you see is that because there's this gap where you can't say that this is a potential treatment, you know, same with hydroxychloroquine, you know, no one's going to step forward and pony up that $2 billion to try to push this. What's been happening is that there's been a lack of authoritative sources that have been able to come out and say, well, hey, hydroxychloroquine, you know, certainly works. And I can tell that it works because I've seen the lengths that the deep state has gone in order to prove that it doesn't work. Bill Gates funded a study about this substance in which the inert placebo that they were testing the hydroxychloroquine against was literally vitamin C, which is known as a potent immune booster. And the people that they selected for the study were not people with full-blown, you know, COVID-19, but people that might have been recently exposed to the virus. And then they were going to be put through this test. And the problem is that vitamin C is not an inert substance. An inert substance is probably more similar to, you know, cornstarch or something that doesn't really have a strong effect on the immune system. And so, you know, and another thing is that in areas where there is a lot of hydroxychloroquine over the counter, those places did fine with COVID-19. Like, look at the whole continent of Africa. They've been almost completely spared of any sort of, you know, death rate from this, you know, supposed pandemic. And hydroxychloroquine is over the counter because it's used as a anti-malaria, you know, drug. In just 100 years ago, the natural form of hydroxychloroquine called quinine was was recognized as so important that they turned it into a soft drink, which is called tonic water, right? Like, if you go and get that tonic water that glows in the dark or glows under a UV lamp, the thing that makes that special is quinine. Like, the health benefits of this substance is not something that we just discovered. It's something that we've known for over 100 years. Hydroxychloroquine just happens to be the synthetic form of that, which has a couple things changed, and so it was able to get patented, and now we've got this, like, really industrialized process for being able to create this drug and give it to anyone. And the thing is that it doesn't cost any money to make. It's like, you know, a few bucks a pill in order to take this thing. Now compare that with remdesivir, which is a patentable drug or patented drug, and it costs $5,000 for a treatment regime. And so, you know, the thing is that the pharmaceutical cartels, they don't want you going on a generic. They don't want you to get sick, and then, you know, when you're getting into a problematic state, then you're going to take anything and spend anything in order to save yourself and get a little extra time. Well, then, you know, here comes remdesivir, and you take that, and then, you know, you spend $5,000, and then maybe you don't die, but you just get really sick, and now you've got to heal for a really long time, and now you're going to need all kinds of treatments in order to alleviate the symptoms of this scarring that's been happening all over your body. And so it's clear, in my opinion, that the pharmaceutical cartels have been channeling us into this position where this pandemic makes us as sick as possible. One of the other horrifying stories that arrived from this whole episode is the fact that in New York and Michigan, the people that would recover from this COVID-19 were then being sent into old people's homes. And I remember that Trump ordered a medical ship into the New York Harbor, and I was wondering, like, what the heck was going on with that? But now it's pretty clear that the reason why that happened was because they didn't want to be an excuse of lack of capacity. And instead of those ships being filled with people that were being discharged from the hospital, an executive order was given by Andrew Cuomo to send these people into old folks' homes. And for people that are hearing this for the first time, it seems like a really extraordinary thing to say, that the governor of New York would literally send people that were recovering from this virus into the most vulnerable population possible. I mean, you would just think, well, that would cause, of course, that would cause a whole bunch of deaths. These people have, you know, they're sick. They probably have, a lot of them have high blood pressure. They've got diabetes. They're not healthy individuals. And now you're going to send someone with a really nasty disease. I suspect I might have had COVID back in March, and I was out for 3 weeks, and it was not a fun time. I was sick all the time, and I was just tired all the time. I was exhausted. Like, just going to the bathroom was an exhausting ordeal. And I can only imagine that what it would be like for someone that's 90 years old. It's a life-threatening, you know, situation. And what's really disgusting is by the very fact that people were, hospitals were getting money when there was a death or a ventilation incident when someone came to their hospital. For example, my best friend's father is a doctor, and he saw someone that was very sick and realized that another hospital was equipped to save this man's life. And so he sent them on a ambulance, and they went to the hospital, and the man ended up dying. And the hospital that employed him got really upset because they lost out on this huge paycheck that would have come for the person dying in their hospital, and said that other hospital got the money for the person dying. And the most absolutely disgusting thing, they reprimanded my friend's dad, who's a doctor, and then he wrote this huge letter and threatened to resign. In fact, he was going to resign, and then this hospital got nervous that this would become a big story, and as a result, they negotiated, and then everything, the reprimand was removed. But that's the kind of politics that we're dealing with about this disease. And people are asking, well, how can this happen? Where's this money coming from? And the answer to that is that we've been looking at the World Economic Forum, or not the economic, it's these globalists. I can't remember what the World Bank or the IMF, But essentially what's been happening is that there's these deals that are being struck. And we know this because the president of Belarus came out and said that he was offered a $900 million loan if he destroyed his economy and did the lockdown. And this is something that we've also been hearing from other countries. Costa Rica said that they had a similar thing, and I think they took the deal. In fact, I know that they took the deal. And the question is, why do the globalists have this?
Zach?
Yes?
Zach, unfortunately for this hour, we are out of time, but that's an interesting question, and we will pick that up in our next interview. Zach Voorhees, my guest. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, brother, brother.